I either sit down and stand up doing the things. I've got a bad back, so it's easy for me to do that. I'm not just being weird. Yeah. To pick up on what Roger said there, the first thing when you try and get into autonomy or workerism, as it's more commonly known for, is the lack of decent material in English. There's plenty of material on Italy, on the period in English, but it's not decent. It's rubbish. It's the sort of rubbish that you get, like say the 70s over here, that said it mentions the unions brought down Heath in passing. So it's not part of a wider struggle, just one page or something. And they're all generally their histories of the big men of Italian politics, Moro and people like that. They don't actually look at the social underlying social struggles that are taking place, the connections between the students and the workers and this sort of thing. As Roger said, that's starting to change now. People have realised that there is real history there and it's relevant to us. But there are also problems with that as well. There's three main problems, and Roger touched on one of them. That's the Negri phenomenon. There is a... Well, I'll come back to it. I'll do the first one, which is the academisation. Is that the one? Yeah. Of Italian studies. Lots of academics have found those little niche things in there. Where, because they can speak Italian, they can get the original research material, look at it, and just develop their own little space for themselves there, and don't let anyone else in. It's not as a sort of part of a social movement. It's not ours. It's their sort of thing. And part of that was the discovery, or just a rediscovery of Negri in the late 1990s, early 2000s. Because Negri writes nowadays in a very ridiculous, jargon-esque academies, it's pointless, you know. Very simple ideas put across in the most wanky way, really. And the academics jumped on that, and they were actually declaring themselves Negrophiles or Negroites and things like that. That's taken focus away from the real good bits that were there at the heart of it. The bits that we really should be talking about, if we want to be radical politically anyway, not rather than getting jobs. And the third thing is the looking at the military aspects of it, just concentrating on the Red Army and RAF and the Red Brigades and frontline and groups like that. Because they were, whilst they were very important to the Italian state, and then, you know, 2,000 people killed over 20 years or so, they were a result of isolation from the wider movement. They weren't the wider movement. They were people who made a decision to militarise themselves, but in that decision they isolated themselves. So when people look at the Red Brigades, they're not looking at the movement again, they're looking at one tiny aspect of it that went one particular way. So that's three first problems with this sort of thing. Also, there's a total lack of translations. The main, most important book from the operas tradition, from the workers' tradition, has still not been translated into English 35 years after it was first published. People just aren't interested because there's no financial comeback in it. There might be in the next few couple of years with, you know, Versa and people get on the back of it. There's some money to be made there, possibly. One other problem, and it seems to be a lot of problems, is that Italy, looking from outside, is a very complex country, politically, culturally, geographically. I don't know whether that would look the same for people looking outside into here, but from outside looking into Italy, it's very, very much so. So you find one thing which you find interesting, and then you find out a few weeks later that that's related to something else that you hadn't realised or hadn't understood as related to that, and you keep going backwards and backwards and backwards. So it's a very complex picture overall. Right, that's just the main problems. What I'll do now is give a quick historical overview of the period from... I'm going to have to cut it off really at World War II and the resistance. If I go back any further, what I mentioned about finding things is just going to go on and on and on, endlessly backwards. Right, okay, historical stuff. Starting with World War II. The Italian Communist Party, the PCI, had a very important role in the Italian resistance. Very important role indeed. In fact, it was the main legacy, it was the main foundation of its legacy post-war, how it became a bulwark of the Italian state, and why it retained the confidence of a huge amount of the working class, really the Socialist Party's majority, for decades and decades and decades, despite problems that I'll come to later on. Now, for the Italian communists on the ground, the partisans and the men on the mountains and the people in the cities, who were armed, they were ready to go. They fought 1943, there was going to be the revolution. They fought after the Muslimi went and they took over many cities in the north and they set up their own networks, they were controlling whole regions, controlling massive production factories and everything. They controlled all these things. They thought, we're ready to go, we're going to get the word, we're going to have a revolution. The word never came. The committees of national liberation were turned into committees of national reconstruction, that is, they were integrated into the state. They were made to work for capitalist development and so on. It was a PCR called a strategy, national reconstruction. They would explicitly block together with the national bourgeoisie, international capital to develop an Italian state that was productive, that was financially sound, and where workers worked, basically. But these guys, they had the guns. They kept them until 1948 because they thought it's a trick. They can't really believe this because a lot of these communist militants have not had any contact with the Communist Party since 1921-22, where it was effectively outlawed and the leaders went to exile or they went into prison. They thought that the communist movement, the international communist movement, they hadn't realised it had been Stalinised. They had turned into a reactionary force. They were actually physically prepared to go because they thought it was the same Communist Party that they had hidden the guns from in 1922. They hid the guns in 1922 when they were told not to fight. So they come out, dug the guns up, 43, ready to go. Thought it was a trick that they weren't told to go. Then the last vestige of that belief died in 1948 when Togliatti, the head of the PCI, was shot three times. They tried to kill him. I can't remember who tried to kill him, actually, whether it was a fascist or just some loon or whatever. They thought, right, this has got to be it. The last time, we've got to go now. And the PCI said, no, this is not right. We're involved in national reconstruction. We're not going to have a revolution. We're not going to have armed insurrection. We're not going to have anything. We're going to work. Or you're going to work. We're going to tell you to work. And that's it. So a split developed at that point between the PCI and lots of the working class, especially the people who were old communist militants and the PCI-controlled unions. And that split later became very important because as the project of national reconstruction carried on, it was built on the backs of the workers. They were asked to work harder and harder. There was not enough capital coming in to update the technology, so the basis was intensification of work. You have to do the amount you do now. What you do in 12 hours, you now have to do in 8 and so on, and speed up the line and stuff like that in the factories. So there's a split there between the PCI and a lot of the working class, but people still voted for the PCI, but it wasn't an ongoing organic link. It's a bit like now where people vote for the Labour Party. They're not going to pick up arms for it. They're not going to go out and riot for it. They'll just vote for it because it's not as bad as the other lot, or they think it's not as bad as the other lot at that point. So in the period from 48 to 62, the National Reconstruction period, there was a this growing split. At the same time, there was a development in the Italian working class. There was really important changes taking place in the composition and in the attitudes, and it was taking place on the basis of this split, because there was no political or union representation that they counted as important. What the main one was that there was a massive influx of rural workers into the north. There was peasants, there was sharecroppers, that's what's called, but there was also a massive influx of agricultural workers, agricultural wage workers, who made their way north to the centre to work in the factories. Now, first thing they found there wasn't enough housing, there was no hospitals, education was crap, there was no spaces for their kids, so they set up shanty towns on the outskirts, like you see in a lot of third world cities now. You even see it in America now again. But so they was people that was there, they had no social services, they were stuck, they were angry, and they had no representation from the PCI as they saw it, and they had no stuff when they drove in the factories. Because another thing was, at this point, in the 48 to 62 period, the communist unions had practically withdrawn from the main factories, and they'd gone into the service sectors and artisans and things like that. They've withdrawn as part of the National Reconstruction Agreement. They left workers with no representation. If they did represent them, it was in the most piecemeal fashion. It was like, for you can have a cup of coffee once a week or something like that. But there was no real representation, so that further opened up the gap there. The PCI was effectively working with the state to exploit the workers at this point, but there were still illusions in them. But this new working class that was growing up in the north, it took its rural traditions of resistance with it, and these were, at that point, they were far from the collective formal, politicised, negotiation-based stuff that the factories have become used to. They was used to violence, it was used to sabotage, theft, even murder. They would literally take out a manager if they thought he was in some way harming their interests. So they brought in a new aggression to the workplace institutions and workplace relations, basically. And far from the normal process, which people, especially crude Marxists, assume is that people leave the country, they go to the factory, they learn the habits of being a good worker, they join a union, then they become a union militant, then they join the party, then they move their way up, and they're educated by the urban worker. It was happening the other way around. The rural workers were coming in, they were being aggressive, they were saying, fuck the boss, we're going to do what we want, and if he stops us, we're going to kill him, or we'll go around his house and firebomb his car. There was a new sort of militant that was joining together the urban worker and the rural worker. Of course, there was internal conflicts, there was sort of stuff you see what people were saying about the poles, they're undermining our wages, they're taking skilled jobs, or they're taking the lower jobs they can't win, they're taking skilled jobs and driving wages down, taking the unskilled ones and pushing wages up so we don't get employed. So there was internal things, there's no like total meshing of them together. So there was an ongoing struggle then between things like housing, education. Education was just getting going because there wasn't the mass influx that happened later on in the 60s, we'll come to that later. And it was generally done on the basis of self-organised forms, or informal forms, or even just hidden forms. And so there was a gap with the unions that eventually came out in 1962. There was a famous riot in Piazza Statuto where the striking workers ended up attacking the union headquarters, started attacking the cars, and they attacked the headquarters, then they attacked the officials, and that was sort of the official point at which there was no going back between the workers' movement at that point and the official, they're supposed to be official representatives. The split was just too big. And so that was up to 62. From then on, it just sort of snowballed. I know it's easy to say that this led to that, but at that point it just snowballed until 69, which was the hot autumn. Things were getting more militant each year, more widespread, struggles were becoming more generalised, and the amount of things they covered were becoming more generalised. They might start off over one little wage dispute in one shop in one factory and spread out to the conditions of the whole factory, then the whole area, it could be housing, it could be rent strikes, municipal rent strikes were all over the shop then, there's loads of things were really developing. In parallel with that, there was a massive influx of students, often sons and daughters of these same new workers, into the universities. The universities weren't funded to the extent they needed to be. There was classrooms with about 2,000 people in them, it was ridiculous. And the students didn't like what they were being taught as well, so they were struggling over the content of their education and the forms in which it was taking place, because there was no... basically, it was you had to fund yourself and this sort of thing. So they was developing in parallel similar sort of militant actions and occupations and so on. But at this point, the two things weren't connected, so they weren't quite supporting each other at that point. Then in 1968, there was a famous student occupation that led to a thing called the Battle of Valle Giuliana, which was an occupation of a university. The university authorities called the police. It was a big battle. The police kicked the students out, and then they were asked to occupy to stop the students coming back in again, which of course led to the students, because it got them corralled in here. We can attack them at will now, almost. And it was a huge battle there. The students kicked the police out and took back the university, and that very much mirrored the sort of workers' battles with the unions. The students saw their battles with the union authorities, and a lot of the union authorities in these places were also run by, because they were living in communist cities, like places like Bologna, where the communists ran the authorities and the schools, everything municipal. And at that point, they were still running parallel, but both very similar, moving closer. In 1969, it became known as hot autumn. Where these things do come together eventually. They do meet, and that led to another cycle that went on until 73, 74. What happened in 69 was the ongoing struggles over wages, housing, education, police violence, fascists in the state. This is another thing I should mention. At the time, there was a a great fear, because of the ongoing tension, fascists would come back, they'd make another attempt to take over the state again. Because everyone knew at that point there was fascists in the highest echelons of every state body, every state institution, every single one, and they weren't just in high positions, they were also widespread, so they had both their influence up there and widespread base as well. And they had a good base in the universities as well. There's lots of fascist students. So in 1969, Pirelli in Milan, they tried to bring in a lot of goods from the Greek dictatorship into the Pirelli factory. I can't remember what they were engines or tyres or something. I can't remember what way it was. And the workers said, bearing in mind they had this ongoing fear of a resurgent fascism, there was starting to become at this point small bombs going around and fire bombers of left wing buildings and things like this, attacks on known left wingers, kneecappings, stuff like that. This was not very widespread at the minute, but that was in people's minds anyway. When the Greek dictatorship's supplies came in, there was a war cave at Pirelli. They said, look, we're not having this. We know what the game is. You're testing us. You're joining up with the Portuguese fascists and the Greek fascists. You're trying to get an arc of like southern Mediterranean fascism. That one had it. So they walked out. And then the boss said, okay, let's try it. We'll have a lockout. So they locked them out. That went on for a while. Then the bosses eventually gave in because it was quite evident they were not going to win the lockout. But then, as soon as they did that, they tried to sack what they saw as the leaders of the strike, because they can only see things in terms of leaders and formal plans and things like this. That's all nonsense. And the workers walked out again straight away. This time it was more serious because the bosses had managed to ratchet up the tension a lot more. And the whole of Milan actually exploded at that point. Factories came out everywhere. There was literally in the industrial zone, there's no work getting done. There was occupations in every factory. And at this point, this is really important, students started setting up roadblocks. They started blocking railway lines. Stuff in and out of Milan was getting blocked. And because of this action, the workers and students got together. The workers' student committees and assemblies, more important than committees, assemblies started developing, where they talked to each other about each other's needs, and then they found that they shared the same needs. They were from the same families before, we had a family coming from the same place in Sicily and so on. The connections were made there. So the Worker Student Assembly, which is really important, is the first real link-up that led to a lot of the stuff that happened later on, happened. Key slogan of these Worker Student Assemblies was, no to delegation, we are all delegates. That is, we're not going to let the PTI or the CGIL, the Communist Union, or Stalinist come in and take over it, negotiate it away for us, say we'll negotiate for you, we'll come back with a deal, you can vote on the deal. If you don't like the deal, you're free to reject it, but we're dealing negotiating. It's emerged, we're dealing negotiating, we'll say what we want, we'll decide whether to extend this, whether to pull it back, whatever. It's up to us to decide. Not just up to us, it's up to the students, and it's up to the students, it's up to the community as well. So there's a territorial base threat rather than just a enterprise level or a university level. So the contacts were made there, that became very important later on. This spread to, also at the same time, another important thing that should be done more is other workers, not in the factories in Milan and also in Turin and other places, helped anywhere they could. For example, the bus drivers and train drivers refused to take fares. We'll make Pirelli pay, we'll make Fiat pay, we'll make Olivetti pay. They refused to take any fares. All municipal things became free overnight, and showed a different sort of way of living. So, we don't have to be dictated by how much we earn and how much Olivetti says we can spend on our own lives. But these things spread to Turin, they spread all over the north and the centre. The assemblies importantly spread. There was cross-union assemblies as well. You didn't have to be in this union to come to this assembly, or this workplace to come to this assembly. Anyone could come, anyone could speak. A voting sometimes was on a special sort of basis. You had to be in the factory concerned, but that was not the main point there. At this, they developed innovative forms of industrial action, things like checkerboard strikes, where a workplace would be divided up like a chessboard into squares and that. And a dice would roll or something, each day that one would come out, that square, that square, that square. So the bosses could get the grip on it. They can't work out where it's going to come next, who's going to go out next, which is an important part. And things like 5-minute strikes were an important, strategically important shot in the factory, walked out, very slowly took its time, and it took an hour, but that hour or so ended up blocking production in that whole factory for a day or a couple of days. And if once production was blocked in that factory for a couple of days, then other factories in the cycle, they couldn't get to do their work. So this one 5-minute strike ended up blocking a whole circle of factories. It was using like capital cycle against it almost. What else did they do? Yeah, they did things like locking up managers in cupboards for weeks on end, stuff like that. So the struggle with this really reaching a high pitch, and this sort of stuff went on to 72 and 73. It sounds like a bit glib and like I'm rushing over it, but these things just carried on and on and on. Once you've talked about one occupation, whatever, you talked about the rest, but they also extended to housing. That's a really key thing, because there were still these shanty towns, there were still families where there was two bedrooms and there was two parents living there and five sons living there until their 30s and stuff, because they couldn't A, afford to move back, B, if they could afford to move back, there was nowhere to go. There just wasn't enough housing. So the struggles were spreading out socially to the social area around the factories and around the universities. They developed at this time this theory of social factory. We'll come to that later, hopefully. I'm not sure what we'll be doing for time and running late. Right, these went on to 72, 73. More and more tension, more and more militancy from students and workers and housewives. And there was different groups like doctors and nurses and stuff were all getting actually really militant. There were a few isolated examples of people on our side doing the Cavendish stuff as well, because people still at this time had the fear of fascism. There was people at this point ready to take up the armed struggle, even though they didn't think it was quite ready. At this point, there was a symbolic changeover of arms. The arms that were buried in 48, some of them were dug up again, because the old militants thought this is the time, but rather than going out themselves because they were too old at this point, they handed them over to the people who saw themselves as direct heirs in groups like Frontline, and not necessarily the Red Brigades at this point, because they were very just a sort of an idea then, but there were groups and arms were handed over. There was a famous picture of a handing over of arms between a group. The picture's called the Men in the Mountains, I think, and it's a really old grizzled communist who's been waiting to get his guns out for years and years, handing over to this like young 18-year-old kid who just looks like, yes, I've got a gun, I'm ready to go. All this stuff was developing up to about 73. Then there was the economic crisis and the oil crisis, and capital said, right, we've got to get a hold on this. How can we get a hold on this? So they went back to their old strategy. Remember, the PCI and their unions have been, they'd retreated from the factory. They didn't run them anymore. The state did everything they could to get the PCI and the CGIL back into the unions, to win in the elections in the factories. And they did. They took control back of the factories, and they imposed, rather than 30% that people win in the factories. Rather than the 30% rises and even 50% rises that people have been winning in the previous years, the PCI said, no, you can ban 5% because it's economic austerity. We're all in this together. So the state and the bosses bent every rule they could to get the PCI back in, and it worked. I don't know how it worked, but it did work. People did vote for this sort of austerity, and it were all in this together nonsense. It was fear of prices at that point. I suppose people thought, If we don't let the PCI get back in some form of control, the fascists will again take over, or the state will collapse, or so on. A lot of the ideas we're hearing around at the minute, actually. So that went through from the sort of pacification period. That went through for the next couple of years. On the surface, everything was pacified to about 77, but underneath, the ties had been made in that hot autumn between the workers and the students and the wider social strata, they were developing and they were still being militant, they were still being innovative, coming up with new things. But it's switched slightly at this point to a sort of cultural level, because there was a lot more youth involved and they had an emphasis on their things on cultural production. They were doing magazines and radios, pirate radio stations and fanzines and things like that, art and all this sort of stuff. There was a slight switching of emphasis there, but it was still developing, going on, bubbling underneath. At the same time, during this period, there was a very divisive national referendum on divorce in 1974, which kept a lot of the more radical elements sort of focusing on that. May come back to that later, because there's an interesting story about one group's reaction to it. Come back to that later. Then things burst out again in 77. It's probably heard of the Bologna Uprising, is often called, or work of the Tribe of the Moles and stuff like that. In Bologna, which was a model PCI city, it had been run by the communists for years and years. It was shown as the way forward for the, going back to this national reconstruction, what I've heard earlier about between communists, Euro communists, because they were trying to paint themselves at the time, local businesses, working class. It's the ideal way. The state run by the PCI can provide social services. The bosses can exploit the workers and take their surplus value, and we can give a little bit of that surplus value back in libraries and things like that. It was the model city in terms of the bosses' state and the PCI state, or the state, but not the working class. There was a lot of police repression when people realised that this is not the ideal state, and it ended up in early 77. The PCI ran police killed a student, or I think he was a student, I can't remember, but it was called Francesco Rosso, and there was massive battles followed all over Bologna and the smaller ones around other cities, which went on for weeks and months, and they became very militarised. There was, for the first time, there was actual armed battles. There was police were fired on many times. Eventually ended up in a massive huge demonstration where the city was taken over for a weekend. It was gun shops were broken into, stuff like this, because all the buried guns had been put away again, probably. And basically, Bologna was took for 2-3 days, for a whole weekend. It was shown that the working class hadn't gone, the students hadn't gone, the alliance was still there. The Sergio Bologna is one of the famous autonomists or workerist theorists of the movement, in the very famous piece called The Tribe of the Moles. Used Marx's phrase about well, borrowed own mole, about how communism or class struggle more than communism is always under the surface, is always there, it always comes out at some point, it always erupts. And this was how the end of the pacification period, it was back out on the agenda again after the PCI had made its attempt. Sorry, I forgot to mention, during this period the PCI had also done what's called the historic compromise. It formally said, this is what we're going to do, we're not going to go for revolution, if you had those ideas you're wrong, we're going to work together with the state and so on again. We're also going to work with the state to hunt down and get the people who are trying to, radicalise students or workers. So that gap between PCI, this was still had, PCI had a massive vote at this time. People were still voting for it, but the workers were against it at the same time. It was a weird contradiction. That was 77. The form of the struggle that happened then went sort of nationwide. There was lots of gun battles. There was lots of guns around. There was a very famous piece. Is it called Comrade? Is it a P-40? P-38. Comrade P-38. It was the favourite gun of the autonomists. Yeah. And there was the posters of this everywhere. It was like warnings to the police. And they were used. So things were really reaching a high pitch again. Eventually, 78, 79, the PCI said, right, we've had enough of this. They cooked up a plan together with the state to take out all the, what was seen in their terms again as the leaders. So hundreds of people rounded up, bunged in prison on totally trumped up charges of being, like Negri was bunged in jail on the Association with Red Brigades, despite his politics, despite winking at the Red Brigades now and again, being very much against their sort of armed vanguardism. So hundreds of people in jail, a very famous thing called After Mark's Jail at the time. They still had some humour, but that was basically the end of this sort of movement at that point, because their massive struggles became to defend the people in jail, the militants in jail, away from the social struggle going on outside. It was wasted years, 2 years of trying to defend the people who was inside, whether they were guilty or not, it's irrelevant, but that's where the energy went at that period. And the factories, the bosses at the same point started kicking out the militants, sacking them. Very famous Fiat in 1881. The workers were totally defeated at Fiat. Every single person they wanted to stay in there was kicked out. The bosses had a field day. It was called the defeat of Fiat, and it set the tone for what was coming in the 80s in terms of working class representation in the factories and stuff like that. And a lot of this was put down, the reason this could happen in the factories is a lot of the autonomists later on said, we had totally ignored the mass worker from 72, 73, the people in the factories onwards. We got this idea in the head of the socialised worker or the social worker, which I should have explained earlier, but this is the idea of everyone is exploited, we're all in the social factory, not just the people in the factory, the actual factory, in the enterprise. We're all exploited, and so everyone, it's like a sort of more militant version of the new social movement spin that's going on with Greenpeace and all this sort of nonsense. So that was basically the death of that movement at that point. It carried on throughout the 80s in various forms and in the 90s. The ideas were still there, but the central link-ups that made them so important had sort of disappeared or gone underground again, like the old mole went underground again. That's the end of that sort of historical context. And what I was going to do now is show this film. This is a film from one of the groups that was involved. They came out, the group called Lotta Continua. They came out of the hot autumn. They were one of the first groups to realise the importance of the link-up between students and workers and the assemblies and no delegation and that. They went through to the economic crisis in about 73. I think they dissolved in 73 after a little bit of argy-bargy. But this is one of their films that they made in 1972. It was supposed to be about an anarchist worker called Pennelly who was suicided during the hot autumn. He was chucked out of the top floor of a police station. I don't know if I remember, the accidental death of an anarchist was written about him. But the film then develops to talk about the historical context of that new working class, that rural working class who would come up to the north, and what they'd gone through, what they faced, that sort of stuff. So it's a really important film in terms of getting something from them, from the workers at the time. And I have to apologise for the quality, it's not very good, but you're really not going to see it anywhere else, to be honest. So there are subtitles, but the film's a bit jerky, so the best we could do, really. It was made in conjunction with Pasolini, who had famously drawn Hot Autumn, just before the Hot Autumn, in when the students battled at the Battle of, what it was called, anyway, that battle in 68, he had come out on the side of the policeman. He had said, in sort of almost deliberate inversion of Orwell's phrase, where he said, every time I see a real flesh and blood worker in struggle with his national enemy, the policeman, I know what side I'm on. Pasolini had come out and said, no, the policemen are the poor, they're the real proletariat, not these students. So it's almost a deliberate version of it. So he, at that point, at 68, 69, had come out against the sort of group that he later ended up working with on this film. This was maybe sort of his penance for that idiocy that he came out with. So I'm going to bring this on now.